and its implications on Asia, being advisors to private clients invested in the equity and credit markets, I think we're all very much looking forward to hearing what Governor Stevens has to say. His background is long and distinguished, with the details which can be found in your program. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming the Governor Glenn Stevens and Lee McCluskey.
Thank you very much, David, for your kind introduction. And thank you to AmCham here in Adelaide for the invitation to join you today. Thanks to Kirsty for leading the singing. It was great to hear you all belt out Advance Australia Fair. And it's good to feel that buzz. As we meet here today, economic discussion in Australia has reached, I think, a rather curious position. Consider the background. Australia avoided a deep downturn in 2009 when most countries did not. A large number of businesses and jobs were saved, actually, by that outcome. We will never know how many, but the number is almost certainly a large one. Almost as a matter of arithmetic, what that meant, a mild downturn, was that the ensuing upswing, which we've had since then, was always going to be of the moderate variety rather than unusually strong. Rapid cyclical growth usually comes after a severe slump, and if it doesn't come after it, it comes just before it. So after a small downturn, usually we have less spectacular growth, and so it's proved on this occasion. I want to just make a couple of points about that. This is a chart of Australia's real GDP, along with those of a number of countries that we might say would be of interest, and they're indexed to a common starting point in 2005, and this picture speaks for itself. We had not very long period of downturn, and we got going again, even with moderate growth. Strictly speaking, it's a little unfair because we should do this in per capita terms. That's what this chart does. That actually makes the euro area and Japan look a little better because their population growth is much weaker. But even measured in per capita terms, Australia has had steady, even if unspectacular, growth since the crisis, and real GDP per head has well and truly exceeded the previous peak. That is something which has not yet been achieved in any of the other countries shown here in this chart. According to data that we had published earlier this week, our real GDP rose by 4% over the past year. Now, that outcome includes a recovery from the effects of flooding in the summer of 2011, and so it's probably a little overstated, but even abstracting from that, the pace of growth is quite respectable and probably close to our long-run trend rate of growth. Unemployment is about 5%. Core inflation, a little over 2%. The financial system is sound. Our government is one of only a small number now rated AAA, and they have a manageable debt. We have received a truly enormous boost in our national income from the highest terms of trade for 150 years. That in turn is engendering one of the biggest resource investment build-ups we've seen in our history. That will see business capital spending rise to a 50-year high over the next year or two. It's certainly true that we face some considerable structural adjustment issues that arise from the mining expansion and from other things that are happening in the global economy. And they're not easy to deal with, although they're hardly insurmountable. And we live in a global environment of major uncertainty, not least because of all the things that are going on in Europe. Nonetheless, it has to be said, I think, that an objective observer that came to our country from elsewhere would surely see our glass as at least half full. Yet the nature of our public discussion is unrelentingly gloomy, and that was true even before the recent events in Europe that have cast something of a pall over global financial markets. We are, and we have been, grimly determined to see the glass as half empty. Now, we get quite a few visitors from abroad at the Reserve Bank, and they all remark on how pessimistic people seem to be when they come to Australia. I travel overseas quite a lot, and it always strikes me how different the perception of foreigners is of our country viewed from afar compared with what I read in the newspapers at home. Now, I harbour no illusion that we can suddenly lift that today by anything I say, but it is hopefully worthwhile to offer a few facts and a bit of analysis of our situation. Much of our discussion proceeds under the rubric of the so-called two-speed economy or multi-speed economy. It's become very much a description of the moment, almost a cliche, and not only in Australia. In fact, you hear very much this theme in many other parts of the world. In fact, it's a description of the global economy. We have growth in the advanced industrial countries is struggling, whereas growth in the emerging world, by and large, when they haven't been hit by natural disasters, has been pretty robust, at least so far. Within Europe, you have Germany has done quite well. Other countries in Europe, as we know, are really struggling, some of them facing extraordinarily difficult times. So in popular terms, I guess you might say that on the global growth highway, there are a number of lanes, fast, not so fast, slow, very slow, and there are some countries in the breakdown lane. In Australia, we've always had, in fact, a multi-speed economy when you think about it. It's been a long-running trend that population growth in WA or Queensland is faster than in, say, South Australia or Tasmania. And you see that reflected in certain industries, like house building would be a typical example. While we debate the rise of mining and the decline of manufacturing, so-called, we might note that a decline in the share of manufacturing in GDP has been a trend that's been going on in this country and indeed in most advanced Western countries for about 50 years. In fact, the reversal of size relatively of mining and manufacturing is taking the respective shares of those two industries in our GDP back to where it was 100 years ago. It's obvious, of course, that the mining expansion is quite concentrated, both industrially and geographically. And the economic data certainly display that. But the mining sector is not the only sector growing at all. If we take the data released earlier this week at face value, the non-mining economy grew at about 2% over the past year, which is probably a little lower than average, but it's growth nonetheless. It's true that mining employment is growing quite quickly, and indeed, according to the data we have, the rise in mining employment over the past year was larger than the decline in manufacturing employment. But other sectors are also seeing growth in jobs. The largest increase of all was in a sector called healthcare and social services, or social assistance, and in that sector, the rise in employment was about equal to the combined fall in employment in manufacturing and retailing over the past 12 months. While there are clearly different drivers by industry and by region, there are mechanisms that even out at least some of these differences. Spillovers do occur, both in the private sector and through the tax and expenditure system. Remarkably, in the face of the understandable concerns that people have had about high-profile job losses in particular industries over the past year, when you look at the dispersion of unemployment rates by statistical region, and there are about 70 or so fine regions for which we have that data, the degree of dispersion today is really no larger than it's been most of the time for the past 20 years. So while there are clearly multiple speeds, and certainly in the shocks that hit the economy, they are differing by region and by industry, the total speed, which ultimately is what counts, so far seems to have been one of reasonable growth and hitherto fairly low unemployment by our historical standards. But there is one aspect of the so-called two-speed economy that I want to talk about a little bit more today, and that's the behaviour of households. I think changes here in that area lie behind a lot of the unease and dissatisfaction that we see expressed around the place at present. So I want to talk about that. Some parts of the economy that depend on household spending are still experiencing relatively weak conditions compared with what they have been used to. But that isn't because the mining spillovers haven't arrived. They're arriving. The real reason behind the changes in household behaviour have nothing to do with the mining boom. They have a lot more to do with things that happened prior to the mining boom even starting, and subsequent events which would have occurred even if the mining boom had never come along. And I want to show you the picture, try to explain that. These are updated versions of a chart I used a year or so back in another talk, and I think the same trends still hold true. Basically, what this shows is real household income and consumption spending. It's measured per person, per capita, and it's measured adjusting for inflation. And there are some trend lines here that are fitted for the period 1995 to 2005 or so. And then you can trace out the history subsequently. And in the bottom part of the graph, basically the difference between those two lines is the gross rate of saving out of current income. And the story here is quite interesting. For many years, spending grew faster than income, and the rate of saving out of current income went down. Those two statements, of course, arithmetically, really the same thing. So the rate of saving fell 5 percentage points or so between the mid-90s and the mid-2000s. Not surprisingly, one of the things that helped drive this was that households thought they were getting richer. And these data show holdings of real household assets, again measured in real terms, adjusting for inflation, and measured per person. We have financial assets, non-financial assets, which is mainly houses, the total at the top, and then in the bottom panel we have the ratio of debt to assets, which is, of course, a measure of leverage. And you can see that wealth grew quite quickly. Just by way of comparison, for the value of assets, particularly the housing assets there, to grow at 6% plus a year, that's very unusual in history. The longer run average would be more like 3%. So we had fast growth in what we thought was wealth. We were gearing up our balance sheets. We were saving less out of current income as all that occurred. And we ended up in a somewhat more leveraged position as households after that had all occurred. Indeed, gross debt compared to aggregate annual income was about 70% in 1995. Today it's 150%, so it's roughly doubled over that time. Correspondingly, the share of our income as households that we spend on servicing the debt went from 7% in the mid-90s to 12% by 2007, even though interest rates in 2007 were in fact lower than they had been in the mid-1990s. Now, I think it's still not generally appreciated how striking and how unusual these trends really were. I can't say that it's unprecedented for spending to grow faster than income, because in fact that had been happening for 20 years prior to the period shown on this chart. So for 20 years before this chart, in fact, spending growth had exceeded income growth and the saving rate had been falling since the mid-1970s. But it is very unusual in history for people to save as little from current income as they were in the mid-2000s. This is the gross saving rate shown here. The ABS also publishes a saving rate net of housing depreciation. That's the one that's commonly referred to. Most of the stuff that would have been in today's papers or yesterday's papers about the national accounts, that will be the net saving rate, and that actually fell to nil during this period of declining savings. So that is very unusual. It's very unusual historically for people's real assets per person to rise at 6% a year on average over a long time. It's very unusual for households to actually withdraw equity in net terms from the housing stock to spend on other things. But in fact, as best we can tell, that was happening for several years in the mid-2000s. So all of that is very unusual. Of course, we weren't alone in seeing these trends. Similar things happened in some other countries, particularly English-speaking countries, US, Australia, US, UK, and so on. Countries that had English-speaking populations, innovative financial systems, and so on, and a big pickup in leverage. The international backdrop to all that was, in fact, a period that economists call the Great Moderation. It's called that because macroeconomic volatility declined. Business cycles were less intense. Inflation was low and variable. Therefore, interest rates were low and variable, and not very variable, low and steady. And as a result of that, compensation for risk embodied in interest rate spreads also went down a lot and were very steady. So that was that backdrop. That moderation, of course, came to a spectacular end in 2007. And with a few years of history behind us now, we can see that the behaviour of our households, along with those in a number of other countries, changed at about that time, maybe even a little before. It's pretty clear that the rate of saving reached a low point sometime around 2004. It began to increase, we know now. It wasn't as clear in the data then as it is now, but we now know they started to save a little more, slowly at first, and then much more quickly as the crisis unfolded in 2008 and 2009. Consumption spending per head actually held up very strongly initially. It reached a peak in early 2008 and then went down, as you can see, for a year or so, before resuming growth in the second half of 2009. But that growth has been much slower than had been observed previously. In the nearly 3 years now since that growth resumed, real consumption per head has risen at an annual rate of about 1.5% rather than well over 2.5%. So more than a full percentage point lower than that earlier trend. And as you can see, the gap between where consumption would have reached had we stayed on the old trend, which surely couldn't have been sustained, but the gap between that trend, where we would have got to and where we are, has become quite noticeable. But in fact, the rate of growth of consumption we see now is much more normal historically than that earlier strong growth that we had been seeing for 10 years or so up to 2007. So that's, in fact, quite a big change if you're in the retailing sector, and that is before we've talked about the growth of foreign online sales and so on and so forth. So that's quite a substantial change, but as I say, the kind of consumption growth that we see now, which is much more in line with income growth, that's actually a much more normal pattern in history than the one we used to have. No doubt reinforcing that trend is, as you can see, that the measures of wealth have stopped growing. In fact, real household assets per head today are about the same as they were 5 years ago. They had a dip in the crisis, they recovered a bit, and then they've drifted down a little over the past couple of years. And both housing prices and stock prices, which are the two main components of wealth, have followed that pattern of down, bit of a recovery, and then drifting down a little bit since then. Now, at some point, I think we can expect wealth to start increasing again. After all, people are saving these days, and they're placing the proceeds into various assets. That is to say, they're increasing their wealth the old-fashioned way by saving out of current income. And ultimately, that will be reflected, I should think, in measures of wealth starting to go up again. In short periods, of course, asset valuation changes dominate those flows. So stock prices or housing prices go up and down. That is what dominates the very short-run movements in these things. But over time, we can expect that wealth will gradually resume an upward track. When it does, though, it's not very likely to rise at 6% a year in real per-person terms the way it was for 10 years up to 2007. My guess would be that, and it's hard to be precise on these things, but something more like 3% a year would be what you'd expect. So I think this is a profoundly important point, and it's worth re-emphasising. The decade or so up to 2007, from the point of view of the behaviour of households, was very unusual. It would be quite surprising, really, if those trends, that is, persistent strong increases in asset values, very strong growth in per capita consumption, increasing leverage, little or no saving out of current income, it'd be quite surprising if those features were to re-emerge anytime soon. That is, the gap between the consumption line on this chart and the dotted trend line where we might have got to, I don't think that gap is going to close anytime soon. So if there were business strategies that assumed that we would revert to the old trend, they're going to be disappointed if indeed they haven't been already. There were, of course, when you think about it, several parts of the economy that benefited from that build-up in housing spending, household spending, and asset values. Retailing, obviously, was one, and everyone is conscious that retailing is finding things much more difficult now. But think about banks. Banks and other lenders enjoyed very rapid balance sheet growth and strong growth in profits from the same set of phenomena. Those institutions can now see that that period is behind us and that things are more difficult now. It's much more difficult to get balance sheet growth and therefore growth in profits now. If you think about businesses that serviced the rapid turnover in the housing stock, like the real estate sector, turnover of housing today is a third lower than its average over the past 10 or 15 years, and it's about 50% lower than it was at the peak. So we are using a lot less of those services than we used to be, and that's having an effect on that sector, and it's also having an impact on state government revenues that come from stamp duties and so on. So the impacts of this change in household behaviour in the earlier period and then more recently have actually spread through some other parts of the economy. We can see some echoes of this, by the way, in business investment spending. Let me just show you that and make a couple of points as well. This is, in keeping with the other charts, it's business capital expenditure, and it's measured per head of population, and it's measured in real terms, adjusting for inflation, and it goes from 1960, quite a long time series. And the point here is that for quite some years, even before the mining boom got going, business investment was growing quite strongly, over 6% a year per head of population, more than double the trend rate of growth in the preceding 35 years. If you take the four strongest growing sectors in percentage terms that helped to make up that strength, they included banking, the retail sector, and another sector called rental, hiring, and real estate services. So at least part of that is the sort of property sector. So we were seeing strong growth in business investment in some of these sectors that face the consumer, if you like, in the economy. And some of those sectors are, of course, slowing down their investment right now. And as you can see, business investment in non-mining has been tailing off for a couple of years now. Meanwhile, mining investment has been growing at extraordinary rates. In 2005, mining investment was about 2% of Australia's GDP, and that is roughly the long-run average, between 1% and 2%. By the middle of 2014, we expect that it will reach at least 9% of GDP. That is more than four times its normal size. And you can see on the chart here, these are, by the way, logarithmic scales, so each increment is a doubling. And so you can see mining investment has roughly doubled, and it will double again over the next couple of years. And by then, it's going to be about as big as mining and as investment in the whole of the rest of the economy put together. So that is an extraordinary build-up in our capital stock going on in the resource sector. And that comes after a pretty strong period, actually, in investment in other parts of the economy. As a result of all this, business investment will, as I said earlier, reach over the next year or two a 50-year high as a share of our GDP. There is a very large build-up, therefore, in the nation's capital stock going on. If that's well managed, and assuming that it's soundly based, it provides the possibility of further growth in output and income over the years ahead. Now, the investment phase of the mining boom will probably start to tail off in a couple of years from now, is our guess. After that, the shipments of natural resources, which are in a sense the return from that investment, should step up quite significantly. One would expect by then also that some of the other areas of investment that remain quite soft at the moment will by then be picking up. More generally, I think over the years ahead, we will be talking about the nature of investment quite a bit because apart from the mining sector, we will have to be grappling with various other structural changes in the economy. If you think about the need for investment in the aged care sector or in public infrastructure, there are quite some big demands that may face us. So we'll be talking a lot about those investments, I think, in the years ahead, and also looking for the productivity payoffs of that investment as time goes by. But the key message I want to leave today, once again, is that the multi-speed economy is not just about the mining sector growing strongly and bidding resources away from other sectors and pushing up the exchange rate. It is doing that, but these changes in household behaviour, which I think lie behind a number of the other adjustments that we see, they were going to be happening anyway, whether or not the mining boom came along. In fact, if the mining boom had not come along, I think we would be feeling the effects of these adjustments by households rather more than we in fact do. The period of household gearing up could well have ended in a much less benign way than it in fact has. Well, what then are the implications of these trends for economic policy and for monetary policy in particular? Do we have any role in helping these adjustments? One thing that I'd like to, that I think I need to say, is that we should not try to engineer a return to the boom in household consumption, low saving, gearing up, and so on. Many people say, they say to me, what we need is more confidence in the economy, and I agree with that, but we need the right kind of confidence. The kind of confidence that's based on nothing more than the expectation that house prices always rise and that an effortless way to get rich is to gear into rising house prices, that isn't the right kind of confidence. And we've been, I think, as a country, on occasion, a little bit too prone to that kind of confidence in the past. I don't think you have to be a believer that there's a bubble in house prices, and I'm not in that camp, but you don't have to be in that camp to think that sizable rises in house prices from where they are now, still quite high, would be a pretty risky approach. It would surely be a false basis for confidence, and the intended effects of our recent decisions on interest rates is certainly not to pump up speculative demand for assets. Now, as it happens, our judgment is that the risk of reigniting an unsustainable boom in housing and so on is not very high at all. And that's a key factor in why we've been prepared to lower interest rates over the past 8 months or so. So I don't think we should be trying to set monetary policy to foster a renewed gearing up by the household sector. We can, of course, at the margin, help the process of those who want to get their balance sheet into better shape with somewhat lower interest rates. To the extent that softer demand conditions have resulted from households or businesses restraining their spending in order to get their debt down, and to the extent that that restraint leads to lower inflation, which it does seem to have, then our inflation targeting framework tells us that we should ease monetary policy, and that's what we've been doing over the past 8 months. The reduction in rates we've had now, 125 points on the cash rate, something less than that, but still quite significant on the structure of interest rates that borrowers actually face, will speed up at the margin the process of deleveraging for those who need or want to undertake it. But it is, as I say, I stress, not designed to actually turn the process back into gearing up again. Now, in saying all this, of course, I'm mindful that we cannot ignore the interests of those who live on the return from their savings and who, quite rightly, expect us to preserve the real value of their savings. And here, you know, it's important to note that a lot of popular discussion about interest rates routinely ignores that dimension. It focuses on the minority of the population, a little over a third, who have borrowed to buy the house that they live in, and it ignores the rest. We, as a central bank, of course, have to adopt a broader focus of that and to consider the interests of savers as well as those of borrowers when we make our decisions. And to repeat, it's not our intention to return to gearing up or to in any way overturn the current more prudent, shall we say, habits of households overall. All that said, I think it can still be said that returns to savers, particularly in deposits, if you do a bit of shopping around, are still quite well ahead of inflation and, of course, they're very low risk. So monetary policy has been cognizant of the change habits of households, the process of balance sheet strengthening that households have been engaged in, and we've been taking that into account in our decision. And in that sense, one element of the multi-speed economy, maybe one that people haven't seen quite clearly, but it's important, that one element of the multi-speed economy, the one most relevant to us, is something that has had some bearing on our decisions over time. The thing that monetary policy can't do is to make the broader pressures for structural adjustment in the economy go away. We can't do that. Not only are the consumption boom and the household borrowing boom not coming back, I don't think, and nor should they, but the industry and geographical shifts in the drivers of growth we're seeing can't be affected very much at all by monetary policy either. To a large extent, they reflect changes in the global economy, and there's nothing that anyone in Australia really can do to influence those. Even if, as a society, we wanted to resist these changes, I'm not saying that we should, but even if we did, tools other than monetary policy would be needed. And in fact, I think, as a country, we do better to accommodate these changes and to figure out how to make the adjustment less difficult and quicker and smoother for those adversely affected. And it's in that area, in fact, that I think we could do with more confidence than we have at present. The confidence in our capacity to respond to changed circumstances, to respond to new opportunities, and to produce goods and services that meet a genuine market need. We've done that before. There's no reason that that can't be done again. And it's, I think, to be hoped that some of the positive data that we've seen just in the past few days might give pause to reflect and to realise that actually, for all the difficulties that are no doubt faced, overall things have turned out not too badly after all, so far. So let me conclude. We face a remarkable period in history. The centre of gravity of the world economy is shifting to the east, towards Asia, towards us, even faster than some of the optimists might have predicted. Now, granted, that's partly because Europe at present is declining in relative importance almost visibly as we sit here under the weight of the internal problems that it has. But even if they handle these problems well in the near term, there's no mistaking what the long-run trend is in the centre of gravity of the world economy. That this comes at the end of a very unusual time for household behaviour and a time when that behaviour has changed direction is in fact a remarkably fortuitous thing for a country like us. We certainly have the challenge of adjusting our behaviour and our expectations to new drivers of growth, new imperatives for responsiveness and so on, but we do that with growing incomes, with low unemployment, and with an exposure to Asia that a lot of other countries would like to have. And that's infinitely preferable to the sorts of adjustments that seem to be facing so many of those other countries in the old world. The Australian community has understood that we can't base growth persistently on falling saving and rising debt. And that's forcing changes to household behaviour, and it's forcing changes to business models as the economy adjusts to that. But it has to be said, I think, that a certain degree of thrift, in fact, on the part of households strengthens our medium-term position. And if we can marry that with an ongoing focus on incrementally improving every day in a thousand different ways the way we do things, that is, that's what raising productivity means. When we talk about productivity, that's what that means. If we can combine better attitudes of thrift and a focus on productivity, then with the opportunities that we face, there's in fact a lot to look forward to. And in that sense, ladies and gentlemen, our glass is well and truly half full, at least half full. Thank you for your attention.
Welcome to the chair. You haven't left me long. I've got lots and lots of questions and I haven't got much time. Mr. Stevens, I wanted to ask you, you talk about, and if you ask around the room, there is very much perception that Australian and South Australian business is currently suffering a crisis of confidence. All the indicators we've seen this week in terms of economic numbers or employment data all say, as you say, not only is our glass half full, but probably merging somewhere towards the three quarters. Whose job is it to lead a resurgence in confidence?
Well, I think it's it falls to people like me occasionally, Lee, to do just a little bit of cheerleading. And yeah. My sort of job, typically, people tend to be more on the dampening exuberance side of things, and central bankers are very good at that. But I think occasionally, if we can, put a few facts out there, give a bit of perspective, compare ourselves to like countries, and just try to get out there that, despite problems, there are always difficulties, there are always multiple speeds, there are always challenges for all of us, but these challenges in many respects can be met and are being met, and I think that's a message that needs to be put. And so it's incumbent on people like me to do our part, and of course on our political leaders and our more thoughtful media also to convey these things.
So it's a thumbs up from the governor.
Well, look, I think, we've had a lot of stuff over the last several months saying things are really keeling over badly, the RBA's behind the game and all this stuff, but apparently not. We seem to be still, gently moving forward, and that's good.
Okay. Obviously, in the wake of announcements such as Tuesday's, and we saw a drop of 25 basis points, the ANZ has come out today, and I think there'll be many happy mortgage owners who they've passed that on. How do you view, when you're trying to formulate what sort of rise or fall there might be in interest rates, is it a bit of an ambit claim? Does the RBA now see that it has to go a bit harder and a bit further, given that a lot of the banks are not passing on the full effect?
Well, it depends on the circumstances, but we've been pretty clear and pretty consistent on this for several years that very few people borrow at the cash rate. We know that. It's a very specialised rate, but it has an influence across the structure of other interest rates, but it's those ultimate rates for the borrowers and for the savers. We shouldn't forget them.
Indeed.
They're the rates that matter. They're the rates that do the work in the economy, and we are trying to calibrate what we do to get what we think are the right levels for those. So we never know in any month exactly how the banks will respond, but then we have a decision time each month where we can, you know, learn from what they've done and make any further adjustment or not as needed. So it's a matter of us trying to calibrate our instrument to get the right ultimate result.
From your perspective, is it a frustrating relationship with the big four banks?
Oh, no, I think, you know, they're doing their job, we're doing our job, and that's the system.
How does South Australia fit into the national economic landscape from the RBA's point of view? Are we still seen as the manufacturing rust bucket? Where do we sit with those who are the power brokers on the East Coast?
I would have thought you've got some pretty significant mining prospects.
Absolutely.
In this country, in this state, and I don't need to tell people here that. So I think we try to keep a nuanced view, and we've got an office here ably headed by David Norman, who's sitting here somewhere, and many of the businesses here would get a visit from our liaison people. We talk to 100 firms a month around the country, including some in this state, this city, and by the way, thank you to all of you who do that. It's very helpful. Please keep doing it, because it keeps us, I think, more in touch than we would be if we were relying only on the official data. So we do all those things, and South Australia's what's happening here gets fed into the big jigsaw puzzle that's the Australian economy every month.
It was interesting you talked about, clearly there is a lot of reliance in this state, and I think nationally around the, you know, the so-called mining boom. But interesting to hear you talk about that things were potentially on the up without that. Do you think there's been too much of a focus on mining and its potential?
Well, it's hard to say that with the size of increase that we're on the chart up there, that we've sort of, in a sense, given too much prominence to it. But I think the thing which should get a bit more prominence is that, the mining sector is expanding rapidly, but the effects of that do flow around. They are subtle, but they're there. And I think people can be forgiven for feeling that, you know, I can't see it. I think that's quite understandable, but it is there, and I think that probably will become more apparent as time goes by, and we've spoken quite a bit about that in the past.
When you talked about the other sectors, why do you believe, those other sectors that are building some growth, why do you believe they're not getting the prominence that perhaps they should?
Oh, well, I think if you think about we hear from the sectors that are struggling, and understandably, if I were them, I'd be speaking up. Some sectors where there's new things happening and people are thinking of new ways to produce products and get on with making a profit and so on, a lot of those are probably pretty busy just getting on with it, and we're not reading as much about them. Where we will eventually find out about them is when we sample 30,000 households a month and ask who's got a job, you know, it'll ultimately show up there, and that'll be something to watch.
Interest rates and interest rates movements are a pretty blunt instrument, and in this two-speed or, you know, patchwork economy that we now face, how does the RBA try and judge what will be good for one is clearly going to have an impact on others? Mm. It must be a constant juggling act.
Well, people say that interest rates are a blunt instrument, and in a sense that's true. I'm yet to be presented with a sharp instrument, actually, for macroeconomic policy. If anybody's got one, please see me later. But look, all we can do, we cannot really make state-to-state or industry-to-industry differences go away. We really have to set our instrument for the average. I've sometimes read that interest rates are being set to try to restrain the mining boom. Not true. They'd have to be much, much, much higher if we were trying to do that. But we're not trying to do that. We're trying to set the right level for the economy as a whole, recognising that, you know, there's a leading edge, there's a trailing edge, but we've got to try to set it for the average.
Time is against us, but I want to ask you two quick questions. Cash rate at the moment sitting at 3.4%. There are some pundits, industry pundits out there suggesting it could go as low as 2%. Is that a fantasy?
It's 3.5.
3.5, my apologies.
Every 10 points is a big
Absolutely.
Deal, as you know. I don't want to comment on the market expectations. I think we've responded appropriately to the information we've had, and
is it out of the question?
We'll put it this way. I think what the market pricing is embodying is they are pricing for a disaster in Europe, which might happen, but it might not.
Speaking of Europe, and there is obviously some speculation about the way in which Europe is travelling. If we were to go into a global recession, how well prepared do you think and how resilient do you think the Australian economy is?
I think we're in pretty good shape. If you think back to 2008, when, by the way, I think we, looking back, I think we handled that pretty well as a country. It's hard to argue with the relative performance on my
Indeed.
Charts. Compared with then, banks are less reliant on offshore short-term wholesale funding, considerably less. And I think the household sector's balance sheet is in better shape. And, of course, we have some macroeconomic room for manoeuvre, and one would expect the exchange rate to play its role in that scenario that you paint. So I think we are as well able to cope with that as any country, which is not to say that we expect to have to cope or want to. Hopefully that won't happen.
That was very politic indeed. Glenn Stevens, thank you so much for your time. It's been
thank
a pleasure.
You, Lee.
Thank
you.
Good afternoon. My name is Peter McGaw from the Commonwealth Bank, and I'm the head of the Institutional Bank for South Australia. It is my pleasure today to propose the vote of thanks. 100 years ago, the Commonwealth Bank opened its first branch